Committee, I welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And as always, we are excited to be here back with you for another week of Chicago Film Talk. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we're talking to producer Colleen Griffin about her new film, An Acceptable Loss. Right now, it's streaming on Amazon. You gotta pay for it. You gotta rent it.
Yep.
Which you probably should. It's like $6.
Yeah, it's an extremely solid watch.
Extremely solid watch.
Jamie Lee Curtis is in it, for God's sake.
Jamie Lee Curtis, Tika Sumpter, directed by her husband Joe Chappelle, and it's also going to be playing at the Midwest Independent Film Festival this Tuesday. You're hearing this on Monday, so tomorrow at the first Tuesdays it's going to be playing. That's your opportunity to see it, have a little fun, stick around for some talks, all that kind of stuff. Shout out to our friend Amy Guth, executive director of the Midwest Independent Film Festival. Also, something, a little housekeeping here, want to get out of the way. We are going to be at the Gene Siskel Film Center Friday, February 8th. We're going to be presenting Rendezvous in Chicago, one of my favorite independent films of last year.
Or the Chicago premiere.
The Chicago premiere. This is the first night. They're going to do a whole run. And honestly, this is the crazy part, is that you can watch this movie four times and you're going to get four different conversations, because we're just doing night one. That's just the opener. We've got so much more coming up. I believe Matt Fagerholm from RogerEbert.com, who we're friends with. He hasn't been on the show yet.
No.
He's next.
He's up. The email is forthcoming, Matt.
We're coming for you, Matt. Matt Fagerholm, RogerEbert.com.
Check that inbox and your junk mail. For some reason, we
probably junk mail. But I mean, there's going to be different members of the cast and crew each night. So realistically, you could go to this and watch it four different times and get four completely different conversations out of it. So,
and if you've seen that movie, you know that that's a good way to go about it.
Absolutely, there's so many facets to it. So again, we'll be there on the 8th. Of February, so check that out. But if you can't make it, you've got three more opportunities to watch it over at the Gene Siskel Film Center here in downtown Chicago. It's one of our favorite theaters.
Yep.
It's a great place to go see a film. But we got to do some, you know.
Here we go.
We talk to a lot of Chicago filmmakers, and we do comment on the film news of the week, all that kind of stuff, and there's a lot to comment on, but sometimes we got to throw ourselves a bone.
Filtering in, I mean, it's impossible to not. Just a little bit of background here. On our very first episode, a little bit over a year ago, there was it was me, and it was you, and it was
Jake S. Wiseman.
And in this motley crew, sort of situated in the center of on the table, was one thing.
It was a book. And it was written by
Frank Herbert in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's called Dune.
Dune!
We're talking Dune, yeah!
Ooh, riding those levels, baby. Yeah, I remember I was in the midst of reading Dune for the first time. And, I mean, you were all about it.
Yeah,
and it's funny because Dune, both being a classic of sci-fi literature, and also having a really interesting film history, because in 1984, I want to say, a film adaptation came out, directed by David Lynch of all people, coming hot off The Elephant Man, which, I mean, interesting choice of director, and I mean. I actually read a great book. It was Lynch on Lynch, which was just conversations with David Lynch talking about his entire film career up to that point. The chapter on Dune is really fascinating.
Yeah.
And I suggest that you all read it if you want some context. But it came out, it was supposed to be like such a big deal. I want to say it was produced by Dino De Laurentiis, who at the time was a very big deal, starring Kyle MacLachlan, our boy,
yeah.
Twin Peaks.
Come on.
Damn fine cup of coffee.
The mayor from Portlandia. as he's known, as he's most successfully known.
I mean,
let's
just, yeah. I mean, even Brad Dourif, you know him.
Hasn't Lynch kind of expressed some regret about the outcome of Dune?
Yeah, I mean, because he really kind of... It was a tough shoot, and right. I mean, we could do a whole conversation about just that chapter of David Lynch's career working on Dune. Just want to jump in a couple more big names. Jack Nance from Eraserhead.
Yep.
Patrick Stewart. Sting.
Sting as Fade Rautha.
Yeah.
As the leather thong clad wearing Fade Rautha.
Max von Sydow. You know Max von Sydow from
yeah, you do.
Yeah, from many Ingmar Bergman films. As
many among, a Bergman.
Sean Young from Blade Runner.
Really?
Yeah, she's Rachel.
Roy? Oh,
Sean Young, Rachel from Blade Runner.
Oh, really?
Her eyes were green.
Her eyes were green.
You son of a bitch. She was Chani.
Okay. Yeah.
But anyway, so this is supposed to be a big deal. Ended up not being a very big deal at all. It has its fans. It has its fans. But it was almost more well known for being a
disaster.
Disaster, yeah. And as I mentioned, it was executive produced, uncredited by Dino De Laurentiis. Music by Toto.
What the fuck were you thinking, David Lynch? What the fuck were you thinking?
They just brought him on. They were just like, you're an interesting filmmaker. Let's see you make Dune. In addition to that, there was Alejandro Jodorowsky's version of Dune.
That was never made.
Never made.
In storyboard purgatory.
Yeah.
Until the end of time.
Yeah. And that was going to be wild. And I mean, there's literally a whole documentary about
that
it.
That documentary is awesome, by the way.
Really good documentary about, if you want to learn more about the creative process, just watch Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary, not the actual Dune.
Because he can't watch it.
But luckily, as announced, you know, when we started the show, I think it was announced that Denis Villeneuve,
who you know from Arrival, Sicario,
Blade Runner 2049.
Nice.
Nailed it.
And he, I mean, if you've been following Villeneuve's career, I mean, you can see that he handles science fiction in a very arresting, intimate way.
Yeah. That's kind of his thing. He's really a really big sci-fi nerd. I mean, one of the movies that he's most well known for is Sicario.
Right.
Not sci-fi at all. But he's, Arrival is under his belt. Enemy is a sci-fi movie.
Yep.
Blade Runner. He's got a thing for it. He's got an interesting thing for it. So it was announced that Denis Villeneuve was going to take over and do a new adaptation of Dune. And there's been a lot of recent news that I didn't really know how many Dune fans were out there.
Right.
I mean, I knew it was many people that read Dune when they were younger or, you know, and really liked the book. But the hardcore Dune fan base is out there. These Arakeen Spice Boys,
yes, are hanging. been waiting to pull out their still suits from their closet because I mean, it's one of those things like we were talking about David Lynch's Dune and everything. I mean, it's a really difficult story to bring to a satisfactory light, I think.
Yeah, and I would describe Dune, if you haven't read it, as like basically Game of Thrones in space, and that's like very reductive, but more or less the point. It's all about politics.
Yep.
And if you like Game of Thrones, if you're looking for something to read, if you haven't already read Dune, fucking read Dune. It is a saga.
It's like a psychedelic rock book.
In a lot
it's
of
like
ways.
It's like the drugs that they end up doing and like the politics behind the use of it, all the entire galactic economy centers around an addictive drug that makes you see into the future. It's fucking nuts. Those words coming out of my mouth is it's unbelievable. And for Denis Villeneuve to be helming this, I liked every single one of his movies. I can't imagine that he's going to not do it service. And something that he said about it for all of the other science fiction fans out there, he kind of roasted the entire man-child Star Wars fan base when he said, Dune is going to be like Star Wars for adults.
I mean, but it really is. It really, if that's one way to put it, because it is so focused on very, like, very heady themes of politics, of power, of environmentalism is a big part of what that book is about. So Denis Villeneuve is going to take it on. I think really the great thing is the casting here. This guy's literally pulling out all the stops.
Yeah.
He's absolutely going for it. Let me just run down the list here. This is there's some that are rumored, some that are confirmed.
Let's just start with the confirmed.
Let's start with the confirmed. All right. Main character, Paul Atreides, Muad'Dib.
Muad'Dib.
My boy.
The Prophet.
The Prophet himself. The Desert Mouse.
The Young Lord.
The Young Lord.
The leader of the leader of the Atreides, Khan Lee.
Yes.
The heir.
Timothée Chalamet.
That's my beautiful boy, Timothée Chalamet, coming in as Paul.
Pretty good. Pretty good choice. I think that's going to be interesting.
And because I think
he's got a McLaughlin-esque like quality to him.
And the way that they're doing this movie, if I'm not mistaken, because there are time jumps in this book, it's separated into three sections.
Yeah.
And they're splitting that into two movies. So I think that
probably smart.
I don't know if they'll recast Timothée Chalamet in the because of the time jump when he is actually an adult.
Yeah.
But I think that him being able to play the younger version of Paul. Before the Gom Jabbar,
yes.
We're talking about. Before the Kwisatz Haderach, we're talking Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing they're going to keep him the same. They're going to just have to handle the time jump a little bit differently. I mean, that's the thing about adaptation, is that you have to take some liberties with it because, unfortunately, you can't age him like a certain number of years.
No.
Or you could just wait. You could just wait to actually make that portion of the movie. Rebecca Ferguson, Lady Jessica. Oscar Isaac, the Duke.
As the Duke Leto.
Dude, that's a pretty inspired choice.
Dude, I was worried that it was going to be Jared Leto. Just for like the end.
I would have laughed so hard. I would have been on board with it. I would have watched it, but Oscar Isaac, he's my boy.
He's better. Yeah.
Dave Bautista as the Beast Raven.
Oh my god. And he is gonna be awesome.
I am so impressed by his ascension to like Kino.
He's like the best thing in every scene that you watch him in. Like, Guardians of the Galaxy, 2049.
Yeah. The opening of 2049. He was the only redeeming part of Spectre for me, honestly. I loved watching him in Spectre.
I still haven't seen that, actually.
You're not missing much.
Yeah.
But yeah, he really takes himself very seriously as an actor, and good. I'm glad. You know, I explore that part of your career. Recently confirmed, Javier Bardem, Stilgar, leader of the
Siege Tabor.
Yeah. Some of the natives of the planet Arrakis.
And a central character in all of the Dune books, if he ends up going on to the second and third.
Absolutely.
Or fourth films or books.
Stellan Skarsgård is the Baron Harkonnen, the big baddie.
And look up pictures of the David Lynch Dune version of that, because you're gonna be seeing some boils. You're gonna be seeing some oozy shit coming out of this guy's face. It's gonna be grotesque.
And then Charlotte Rampling as Reverend Mother Moyam.
I don't know.
But you know, leader of the Bene Gesserit, the fucking space witches who are like engineering the entire universe to their will. It's fucking crazy. It's awesome. I just want to get across to everybody listening right now how much we love Dune.
It's so hard to talk about it in like a measured way when you feel so strongly about it. You know, I think it's because it's nuts. It's a nuts story, and I understand if people aren't or like wouldn't give a shit about it, right?
Sure.
But there's a depth of imagination there from Frank Herbert that is, if you aren't interested even in the movie, just like pick up the book in a bookstore and read a couple of pages, because that guy's writing is, I don't know, it's inspiring, and I feel like I haven't read somebody write like that before.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And for such a heady book,
yes,
it's 800 pages, which is, if I'm not mistaken, the length of the first Game of Thrones book. It's written in a way that is still compelling, that sometimes this level of science fiction world building can be like a slog. Like, honestly, one of my favorite sci-fi books of all time is Solaris.
Sure.
And that is some very hard sci-fi. That is not Dune. Solaris is very much focused on like process, yeah, and like explaining every piece of machinery, all that kind of stuff, and being very, very like strict with it, and it can be a slog to read.
Dune, and if you don't value that kind of thing, I mean, that exactly becomes, yeah, a slog.
But Dune still touches on, like, it really world builds, and even with the David Lynch film, he does a pretty good job of really trying to get across that this is a big world that they're dealing with. We're talking about interplanetary, just like economics,
yeah, and economic warfare.
It takes something that should be like really boring and makes it super interesting.
If you describe events in this book like we were doing earlier, I mean, it sounds batshit, but the way that he writes it is far more compelling than it frankly has any right to be.
So we're super excited for this. I'm guessing we're looking at like 2020, 2021.
Yeah.
So it's really down the pipeline, but
take your time, Denny. I know you're a longtime listener, but just take your time. You're excited. You're excited. We get it. But
and give us the 4-hour cut. Don't fuck with me on this 2049 shit.
Let's
where you're
not
just like,
do Blade Runner now. We can't do Blade Runner.
But it's so intertwined because, yeah, it's, again, he's adapting a beloved sci-fi property and he's got to put a mark on it. And my only worry is that people are not really going to go see Dune because it's got a little bit of the same problem as 2049, where, and maybe less so, because you're basically not going to enjoy 2049 if you haven't seen the original Blade Runner.
Right. It's like, niche.
It's very niche. Dune is asking you to basically jump headfirst into this crazy world where people, like, literally, as you said, do drugs so they can see into the fucking future. Like, it's very of its time in that sense, where it takes a lot of risks, where people are looking for sci-fi that is probably should be more like Blade Runner, which is kind of grounded, has a sense of reality to it, whereas Dune is not that. Dune is way out there. And I compared it to Game of Thrones earlier, but Game of Thrones is like very situated in like historical medieval fantasy.
Right.
Granted, there are dragons, but that's like really the only, there's like one of the few,
there's hardly any
conceits,
real imaginative world building in Game of Thrones by my estimation. If we're talking about Dune and Game of Thrones in the same conversation, it's,
yeah,
like,
no, it's less trippy. It's very grounded in reality, and I think that's the key to a lot of Game of Thrones success, is that even if you're not super on board with fantasy elements like dragons or magic or things of that nature, you're still brought in by the groundedness of, like, yeah, they're in a castle. Castles exist. Like, these are, they're, it's like based on real kind of history with a little bit of extra shit thrown in.
Right.
And it's really not even introduced until much later on, once you've got the grounding in the world. Dune kind of does that, but it also goes right off the bat. If you read the book, like, crazy shit's happening, like,
immediately.
Almost immediately. Yeah. And requires a certain level of, as you said, imagination. Like, it's going to have to recapture people's almost childlike wonder,
yeah,
at, like, things that are impossible.
Well, you pick up the book and you're immediately presented with all of these terms that you have no ability, unless you fucking studied the glossary ahead of time. I mean, there are, you're getting words like Gum Jabbar, you're getting Kwisatz Haderach, you're getting Arrakis and Caladan and Secula Secundus. It's,
yeah,
like, none of this shit makes sense, and he doesn't coddle you. And he treats, as a reader, I appreciated this. It's sort of like if you're watching a kid's movie that doesn't treat its audience like they're fucking idiots.
Yeah.
It's like you are in this world and you're along for the ride.
Yeah.
And
open
yourselves up and you're going to figure it out, and it's going to be that much more of a rewarding experience by the end.
Yeah. I'm serious. If this is handled, well, and I think a lot of it's going to fall on the marketing, as a lot, yeah, of film does. I mean, there's a lot of great movies over the last few years that people complain about because they're just like, oh, this isn't the movie I thought I was coming to watch.
Right.
And hopefully this is a movie that markets well and knows what its messaging is. I think Blade Runner fell a little bit victim to that, where people are just like, I don't know what the fuck this movie is. Like, what is Blade Runner? Even though Blade Runner is arguably one of the most influential, one of, if not the most influential sci-fi work next to maybe Dune.
Yeah.
Because Blade Runner like defined what helped define what cyberpunk looked like and all that kind of stuff, and gave a lot to cinema in general, a certain aesthetic that people have recreated, copied, and all that kind of stuff as a good thing.
It's in the Library of Congress archive as a culturally important piece of art, and yet it was panned when it came out.
Yeah. So it's one of those things. I'm really nervous because Blade Runner 2049 did not do particularly well in the box office, despite its critical success. It had critics loved Blade Runner 2049. They thought it was great. So I want Denis to succeed, but we'll just have to see how this one plays out. Obviously, the hardcore fans are going to go see it, but it's not us that they're worried about necessarily. Because
of course we're going to go see it.
Of course we're going to see it, whether or not it's good.
We're white dudes getting thrown a fucking sci-fi bone. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Before we go on to our conversation with Colleen, would this have worked more as a Netflix series?
I think that that's a really interesting question.
That's a question that we have to ask ourselves. And full disclosure, I'm kind of stealing this from a podcast called The Rewatchables, which is one of my favorite film podcasts. And it's one of the questions that they ask themselves is, would this movie work as a Netflix series? And I think that's an incredibly like modern question to ask, because so many things are just like, well, I don't know if we want to put all the chips in making this a movie,
right?
Two, 3 hour experience. What if we make this a bingeable fucking TV show that anybody can watch at home and then just like tweet about and talk about how they're so obsessed with it?
I mean, the question, regardless of, you know, ignoring the format and the episode format or whatever, I mean, what you're talking about is, are we going to get 4 hours in this world, or are we going to get 12? You know, that's what you get when you get that long list of episodes. So, yeah. Of course, with a book that's as dense as Dune, it probably would have made more sense, frankly, in terms of adapting this book into for the screen. I think it would have made more sense for it to be in a miniseries, but to say that, you know, you won't be able to capture the story and the scope of everything, I don't think that that's fair necessarily.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to see. When they said they were doing it as a movie, I'm like, we've tried, and they have tried it as a television series as well. Sci-Fi did it as a mini series,
right?
So I guess maybe format is not the question. It's more of who are we dealing with? How much is the studio going to get involved? How much are they going to try to? And maybe this is a pretentious way to put it, but how much are they going to dumb it down so that it has a broad audience? Obviously, you want to find some sort of middle ground, because if you just make this 4-hour fucking epic for people who already love the book, it's not going to be a success.
No.
It's going to be a waste of a few, you know, tens of millions of dollars and a lot of talent if it just becomes a cult classic. Cult classics are great. I love cult classics, but I'd rather see this movie succeed. I want to see Denis Villeneuve just be given bigger and bigger budgets.
Yep.
So, As some Dune boys, some Sandy boys,
a couple of Sandy boys,
a couple of
spice heads,
yeah,
Arakeen spice posters, couple of worm riders.
Don't tell them about the group. Keep
it secret. Sorry.
can we be honest? We are definitely part of a Dune meme group.
We may or may not be a part of a group whose sole existent purpose of their existence is to create sand based memes. Spice-based, Melange-based memes.
Shout out to our fellow Spice posters who may or may not actually listen to this show.
We're out there. You look around
there
on a public bus.
There are literally dozens of us.
Tens of thousands.
So all that aside, I think it's really interesting when a director takes another crack at a property.
Yeah.
I think Denis Villeneuve
is
the guy
to do it. He's proven
himself. Yeah, I think he's the guy to do it. So with that said, we've got the Dune out. We've released the Dune.
Clean out those steel suit valves. It's not over. It's never over.
Oh, this is just
Beast Rabin was a false flag operation. Beast Rabin's promotion to leader of Arrakis was a false flag operation.
This is literally as esoteric as it gets, mm-hmm. for us is when we go deep on Dune.
It's been there since the beginning.
It's been there since the beginning. I'm definitely going to reread it. I think I'm just going to go on Amazon and just buy all the books.
Yeah.
At least all the ones that Frank wrote.
I've got them for you if you want to borrow them. Nice. You got to read up to God Emperor. And then you can stop. Or Chapter House, I guess. But yeah. I would have
God Emperor, fucking worm god.
Wormy boys.
All right. Now, all right. Now that we've said all we can about...
What do you mean?
Dune. All right. Let's get into our conversation with producer, director, and writer Colleen Griffin. She's got a new film out with her husband. It's called An Acceptable Loss, starring Tika Sumpter and Jamie Lee Curtis. Let's go talk to her now. We're so lucky to be talking to a fantastic filmmaker and producer. There's a new film she's out here promoting. It's called An Acceptable Loss. It's distributed by IFC. You all know IFC, one of the biggest independent film distributors in the country. And it's actually directed by her husband, Joe Chappelle. Of course, I'm talking about filmmaker and producer Colleen Griffin. The film An Acceptable Loss follows Libby, and she's a teacher at a university. But 4 years ago, she was top aide to Vice President Rachel and was part of a total victory action. Rachel is now a U.S. president and worried about Libby keeping quiet. And Libby also has a little bit of a stalker, someone spying on her, following her around. So it's a little bit of a, I guess I would describe it as somewhat Tom Clancy style thriller, heavy military themes, questions of power, questions of,
it's a political
ethics
thriller without being really overtly political, I think. It's just, it's digging into one of the things that you don't really talk about that much, like the choices that the people in power have to make when they are confronted with an opportunity to further their, their agenda, I suppose.
Yeah. And frankly, I found it incredibly gripping, especially with fantastic performances by Tika Sumpter as Libby and none other than Jamie Lee Curtis as Rachel, the sort of oligarch of power in this sense. She is
The
fantastic
architect of the human suffering that takes place in this film.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. And she is fierce in this movie. I love seeing Jamie Lee as a villain.
I know. I was gonna say I can't remember a time where she's behaved like that, honestly. I mean, she's been a heel in a lot of movies, and even in like the new Halloween, she's got a little bit of that, she's a little bit difficult, but I don't know if I've ever seen her outright in like a villain role.
Yes. So again, this is An Acceptable Loss. Right now in the studio, we have Colleen Griffin, producer of the film. Thank you so much for joining us, Colleen.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, An Acceptable Loss, which is available now on Amazon,
anywhere
iTunes
films are streamed.
Pretty much. You can get that rental right now, watch it in the comfort of your own home, but you can also watch it coming up at the Midwest Independent Film Festival first Tuesdays. By the time you're hearing this, that's going to be tomorrow. So you can still get your tickets. Go on out there. I think this is a movie that you'll really enjoy seeing in the theater. Colleen, tell us a little bit about getting An Acceptable Loss out there and distributed and people seeing it.
Can I go back a little bit to just even the genesis of it?
Yeah, please.
That's
okay.
Yeah. So Joe Chappelle, my husband, is a producer, was a producer director on Chicago Fire. And sort of, I think, the winter hiatus of 2015, he started thinking, we wanted to collaborate again. We had made a film in 1993 called Thieves Quartet. And we wanted to collaborate again. So he kind of came up with this idea. He had seen two Errol Morris documentaries, Fog of War and Known Unknown, and he kind of liked the idea of having two people, one like Donald Rumsfeld, who looks back at his engagement in war and is like, do it all over again, exactly the same, and then Robert McNamara, who looks back at Vietnam and is like, filled with regret, filled with remorse, wishes he had lived a different kind of life, I guess. And so Joe's sort of like, what if I put two characters kind of modeled on those guys on the same side of one event, one American event? And then Joe will credit me with saying, like, hey, what if those two people were women? And so he's like, I love that idea, and he went with it. And then fast forward, he's written the script, and we sent it out to people, and we had gone out to a couple people, and we sent it to Jamie Lee Curtis, and she's like, I love it, I'm on board. They talked about it, and we cast her in like February of 2017. Yes. I get my 100% get my dates wrong. We shot the summer of 2017. We finished it that fall. And then we started submitting to festivals. We did not really get much festival love. But we did have a screening in New York kind of at the same time as Tribeca. Mm-hmm. We brought in a really fascinating panel of women in politics. Wendy Sherman, who was the former undersecretary for under Obama. Diane Allen, a former state senator from New Jersey. Tara Dowdell, who's a political consultant. And then Kelly Dittmar, who's with the Center for American Women in Politics. And they looked at it through the lens of, like, themselves and other women being in politics. And we had this fascinating discussion, and that kind of led over the next couple months to IFC picking it up and offering us this limited theatrical release. And then doing this type of release is called a day of date. So you release in select theaters, but then you also are available on all the platforms you mentioned mm-hmm. On the same day, which has some challenges with it.
Sure.
Because generally the big cinemas won't take that. They won't take a film that is released that way. But then it's sort of I think this is one of the parts of the industry that's sort of like the Wild Wild West. All these distribution patterns are changing and getting turned upside down. I think day and date may become more standard
move
forward.
We're seeing that in more common big budget things as well. I know a great recent example would be deals that Netflix made with Paramount regarding movies like The Cloverfield Paradox and
right.
also Annihilation, and that was granted limited to the international streaming rights, but I believe it was for Annihilation, which is one of my favorite movies of 2018. That was about 17 days, so a little over 2 weeks. Had its regular run in the U.S., had the streaming internationally, and frankly, I'd be willing to wager that the streaming model might have helped the film a little bit more in terms of getting eyeballs watching it, because Annihilation was a movie that didn't have a lot of, I don't know, broad appeal. It's, you know, a very cerebral, very high concept science fiction film. Granted, it does have a star, Natalie Portman, not unlike An Acceptable Loss having Jamie Lee, but people are just like, okay, what am I watching here? And when you have the barrier of saying, oh, I have to go to the theater, I have to pay X amount of dollars, and I have to get my popcorn, and I have to do this.
Right.
It seems like it can be like, oh, maybe I'll just pass on it, which we don't want it to do, because Annihilation, like An Acceptable Loss, is a very good watch. We want these movies to be seen. So if you can entice them with, like, you can literally stay at your home, press two buttons on your TV, and you're watching Jamie Lee Curtis give a fierce performance as a cutthroat politician, you've sold me on that, honestly.
It's concerning, honestly, how frightening she is in that movie.
Yeah.
I'm glad she wanted to get on board. I mean, what's it like sending a script out to someone of that caliber?
Well, it's really, it was a fascinating experience, because we went to a local casting director. We're based in Chicago, despite Joe, all the TV shows he's done and stuff like that. We've always lived in Evanston, and we've always wanted to work in Chicago. And so we went, but it's the way that you do it, like, in the real world, unless you're like, you know, Ron Howard or Steven Spielberg,
sure.
is you get a casting director, and then they get coverage of the film, and then it goes out to all the big agencies, WME and CAA and stuff like that. And then they will send you back a list of people who are available. And then you kind of do this mix and match and go, oh, one from column A, one from column B. These people, this is the window. We had a very distinct window of when we could shoot because of Joe's production schedule on television shows.
Right.
So we were like, we can't go like, oh, we'll wait for this actress, because we had to sort of be in this window. And so that way it's just kind of like putting a jigsaw puzzle together, and you're like, then you start at the top of your list and you send it out. They get about 2 weeks to read it, and then they come back, and sometimes they'll tell you why they pass and sometimes they won't. And then you just keep going, and you're always just in every stage of production, you're sort of like, okay, is anyone going to read it? Is anyone going to say yes to be in it? Now, are we going to be able to raise the money? Are we going to be able to raise all the money? Are we going to be able to pay for, you know?
Yeah.
So when she said yes, that was like a big hurdle. But then we still had to cast Libby, and we knew we wanted there to be diversity. Like, we really wanted the film to look like the world we move through. So we didn't, we were very specific about, like, if Rachel ended up being a woman of color, then we wanted Libby to be a different race.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is some, just like I said,
representation.
Yeah, yes. And just that it looks more like the world that we move through.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that it. Can I ask you? I don't know if this is an overly like personal question or something, but you mentioned that is this the second film that you've made with your husband as a filmmaking team?
We did a film in 1993, and then we did this film. We did another film that he wrote and I produced, and another friend of ours directed.
So. And that was in 1993, you said? So mm-hmm. That was when I was born, actually. That
yes,
was the year that I was
us,
born.
Actually.
So
I'll be 60 in June, you guys.
What is it like having a partner that, while you guys obviously have your own careers, that like he obviously is in TV and you have your other pursuits and everything, what is it like coming together at the end of the day and being like, let's work on a passion project and make a film that just so happens to have Jamie Lee Curtis in it?
It's really, I mean, most of the time it's really fun. Sometimes there's the dark night of the soul when you're like, maybe something happens and you just have this knot in the pit of your stomach when you're like maybe you, like the money isn't there. We had an investor drop out and that's me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, are we going to be on the hook for all this money? Or he might see some footage or see as part of a performance that he's not. And he's like, oh, but most of the time I'm like literally the president of the Joe Chappelle fan club. I think he might be the president of the Colin Griffin fan club.
There's too many people to name.
Yeah. But we really like each other, and we both think that we're closer now after making this movie than, you know, it helps that like he's done a lot of TV shows where he's lived in other cities and we've had like time apart, but we're really collaborators and we share this very distinct vision of what film should be, and we love Chicago. We want to make more movies in Chicago. We just think we have amazing actors and crew people, and you know, we just, it's sort of a shared passion.
Huh. And you guys both come from you know, this filmmaking background. You mentioned off mic that you both graduated with MFAs from Northwestern in mm-hmm. film.
Yep.
And you both have, I'm guessing, your own ideas about what you want your careers to look like and the things you want to work on. So it seems to me that when those things can overlap, that's going to create a really interesting product. You've got two well-versed filmmakers, if you can get them together, whether that's in marriage or in filmmaking, I think that's going to create something really special. And when it comes to an acceptable loss, watching this, you know, there's a lot of political thrillers out there. It's a very well-worn genre, and I like it. Generally, I like watching political thrillers, but sometimes it gets stale because it does fall into the tropes of I'm watching, you know, two white men
right.
Argue about the nature of power mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. So it was really fascinating to watch these two women get together and basically pass the Bechdel test and have real conversations about real big questions that women are facing in the political sphere. One of the things that I really enjoyed was this sort of focus on Libby's femaleness in the sense that like she's got this stalker, and that seems like something that would really happen, is that this other character Martin is stalking Libby not just because she's a figure of political controversy, but I don't know, it feels like he thinks he can get away with it because she's a woman. I don't know, do you think there's any validity,
and
to
maybe
that?
Because she's like a political pariah as
yeah.
well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just can imagine, like, what, you know, somebody like Condoleezza Rice or, you know, someone like that experiences. And there's so many things in the film that some of them are absolutely deliberate. Like, this, you know, because Joe loves genre pictures. And so we've always been sort of fascinated with the idea of kind of subverting genres. So you think it's one kind of a thing, and then maybe it evolves into something else. And, like, the language can change. And if you're not, like, too concerned about absolutely being spoon-fed every trope that, you know, like it does kind of start sort of slow with this little stalkery thing, but that's not really, you find out that's not really what the movie's about.
No.
And I think there's things in there that even when he wrote it, never, like, there's a scene where she's having a dinner, she's having a conversation with a guy at a cocktail party, and it's sort of like, it seems like Joe wrote it in answer to the Me Too movement, but he wrote it like three, you know, like.
Is that the question when he's asking her about the things in her house?
Yes. Yeah.
When I was watching that, I was like, only a man would ask that to a woman. I was just thinking, you would only ask these questions like, oh, you moved into a new house to get lonely?
Yeah.
What do you sleep on? It's fuck.
And it's really slimy and like the way the world has moved, like when Joe wrote this, he thought this is kind of implausible. Like I don't want to do spoiler alerts, but then Trump got elected and now we're sort of like, this is not really that outlandish at all. In some ways. Like even this week, there's been like two or three articles about, you know, what's happening with nuclear weapons so it sort of touches on those things. I'm sorry, I don't even know if I answered your question.
A lot of it is, you know, it's having a film that has two female leads like this speaking in a way that female leads don't often get to in this genre of movie, really in any sort of movie. I think we have to be careful not to focus too much on that. Insofar as that, it's like, it's not an oddity because it shouldn't be an oddity.
Correct.
This should be the type of movie that we see more often and go and enjoy more often. And frankly, the conversations of power and unilateral military action is really what's super salient about this movie.
Right. I think even a friend of mine said one of the things they liked about it is that their womanness or being women had nothing to do with the film.
Yes.
It's just that they happen to be female actors. And we even had, before we, you know, finalized the cast, people were like, well, are you sure you don't want to, on all levels of the industry, are you sure you don't want to make one of them a man? Are you sure you don't want to, like, you know, before Trump got elected, some people were concerned that, like, if Jamie was such a villain, oh, it's just going to reflect poorly on Hillary when she becomes president. And I was always like, everybody remember Lady Macbeth? Like, we want, like, women actors don't get to do, you know, unless they get to do the full spectrum of emotions and complex, nuanced, flawed characters, they're not really getting to act at in the same level as men. So let them be not one notice. You know, they can be more than just a girlfriend or a wife or a mother.
And it's a shame to say it, but I honestly, the fact that you casted two women, it really opens up opportunity for subversion of expectation, right? Because you can play it in a way where they're not being victims because of their womanness or femininity. They're victims because of the choices that they made, which is, like you guys have both said, it's within the realm of political thrillers and overwhelmingly white male narratives.
I don't know that there is another political thriller where both leads are women.
Yeah.
Where the protagonist and the antagonist are women.
Right. Yeah. And I love Jamie Lee. I'm sorry. It's so good because it's strangely prescient because you guys started working on this before Trump got elected and it takes on a certain meaning now watching it. But I think there's something specifically Bush era about a lot of this, especially Jamie Lee's, like,
Dick Cheney. Yeah,
exactly. I couldn't help. I was like, wow, she did a better Dick Cheney than Christian Bale.
Jamie Lee Cheney.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
And I just, you can see that she's really reveling in the ability to play a villain that does have a certain ideological point, but it's just specifically so militaristic. Yeah. And
yes,
I believe
Jamie
her.
Does not think that she's a villain. She thinks she thinks that Rachel is a person who is keeping her country safe.
Yeah.
And she is doing what she's supposed to do, which is the crux of the conversations, I think, between, you know, different types of people that have different worldviews. Like, how do we keep ourselves safe? Is it with military? Is it with, you know, diplomacy? Is it with building bridges? What's the answer? Mm-hmm. And she is She doesn't think she's a villain.
No, she's doing exactly what she needs to do.
She's rooted in her perspective.
She's very comfortable with her actions.
And I also think that she's painted in such a way where, like, she's a hard worker. You know, like in that scene in the war room after the whole I don't want to, no spoilers obviously, yeah, but after the decision was made, right? Mm-hmm. She stays there and she's typing, and there's, mm-hmm, that guy that's just sort of like looking at her with this he's astounded that she's got the will to carry something out,
sure,
and
sure,
she's
sure,
just typing away.
Yep,
she's prepping the media,
getting stuff done. Yeah.
You know,
checking, yeah, things off. Her
and
list.
The president turns on a football game.
Yeah, yeah.
When
hurt.
I won my third championship at Texas,
yeah, I was like, that was it. It was very darkly comic in a way that's just really kind of hurt. I was like, man, I bet that kind of happens a lot. Like people make, you know, life ending decisions. Like, yeah, we're gonna throw a drone over this Syria. And
like
we're
I threw
this.
That 30-yard pass.
Yeah, it's disturbing, no, and yet comic in a way, mm-hmm, because that's the only way you can deal with it. Is just like, well, you've got to have a little bit of a laugh at someone's expense while you're still dealing with the fact that there's people at the top echelon of this country making unilateral military decisions that could completely wipe people off the map, destabilize entire countries, and that's really what I took away from this movie. And we've talked a lot about Jamie Lee. I don't want to take away from Tika Sumpter as Libby, who plays this role with an incredible level of trauma, an incredible level of poise as well, mixed together,
yep,
where you can see where she's trying to put on, like, I need to be the strongest version of me. I have to be this accomplished political figure. And at the same time, she's sleeping with a gun underneath her pillow. And
she's no dummy.
Yeah, no, not at all. Tell us about finding Tika and getting her involved.
Well, that was really like sort of like, you know, these things happen, but we had originally, Olivia Munn had accepted that role, and she was delayed. I think she was working on Predator, and the shoot went long,
yeah,
and it was a hard shoot, and she didn't have a relationship with Joe at all. And so I think it was... This is probably like an expose right now. You guys are getting an exclusive.
Well, thank you. Appreciate
it. So, yeah. So, Olivia had to bow out, and she bowed out like 3 weeks before, maybe 2 weeks before. Oof. And so we went out looking, and, you know, then we were sort of like under a gun. And Tika is amazing. Like, she read the script. She said she wanted to do it. She was working on her last season, I think, with the Haves and the Have-Nots with Tyler Perry.
Okay.
So yeah, she came up to Chicago on a Saturday, and she did like all her wardrobe fitting. She had a 10-month-old. She has a child, but her child was 10 months old at the time.
Oh, my gosh.
So she goes back to Atlanta on Saturday, shoots Monday and Tuesday, finishes the season. Tuesday night, flies back to Chicago, starts shooting for 7 weeks on Unacceptable Loss Wednesday morning. So
that's incredible.
It's really incredible. And she did such... I mean, I think she's just... she's haunted, and she just, that's the quality we wanted.
Right.
We wanted that, and I think she, and dignified and intelligent, and just, she's trying to deal with the repercussions of her actions.
And she's got an amazing amount of range, just in, not just in An Acceptable Loss, but also in her previous work. I mean, things from Ride Along with Ice Cube,
yep,
and Kevin Hart to, you know, she's in The Old Man and the Gun. She was in Southside with You. As you mentioned, The Haves and the Have-Nots, which Tyler Perry often expects his actors to do quite a range of emotions, ranging from slapstick comedy to some really hard stuff. So I mean, she just slides into this role, mm-hmm, with so it seems so little effort. I'm guessing she had to put a lot of effort into it. As you mentioned, that schedule is brutal.
Yeah,
brutal.
And the what you described, that situation where Olivia Munn dropped out a few weeks before, I mean, that's like one of those dark night of the soul situations, right? And you're thrown into a situation where you could have had an actor that could have just phoned it in, right? But instead, you get her coming in, flying in out of Atlanta, at working 4 days a week on a paisley schedule, being a mom and everything. And she's got all of these little synchronicities in her performance, like the way that she throws her voice in certain scenes, particularly the scene in the kitchen stuck out to me, where the man is drunk and accusing her, and she, you know, and then there's the emotional fallout afterwards where she goes home. I was really struck by that, and to hear you say that she was like a 3-week, you know, before shoot add-on right, is unbelievable.
And it's nothing against Olivia, because I'm sure Olivia would have done a great job.
Sure.
To me, I think of it as like a happy, such a happy for us accident, because I feel like she just was the role, and I think I don't know. I'm sort of speechless with her performance because I think it's so beautiful.
Yeah. As a producer, I mean, this is how things go. You have to roll with the punches. We've talked to numerous guests that say a lot of filmmaking happens on accident. As much as there is a lot of planning, as much as there has to be a lot of focus put into the filmmaking process, it's still a very artistic process, whether you are on camera or off camera, where things are just going to happen. You were an extremely accomplished producer. I was hoping you could give us an insight into how you define your role as a producer, because it's a little bit amorphous. Some people do more of this, more of that. But when you start working on a film as a producer, how do you get started?
Well, I feel like this project was a passion project. Joe and I just wanted to work together again. And so we had been looking for the right project. We have three kids, and I kind of took a little backseat. And I actually directed my first feature at 53, and it was a sort of a hybrid horror psychological drama. And then I did a mockumentary about fake boy bands. So I kind of do a spectrum of things. But I sort of wear two hats in this film. My one hat was that I had to raise the money, but we had an amazing executive producer, Candy Strait, who we met through IFP Chicago. She brought her film Equity here, and I met her, and she is a big, she's very passionate about women in politics. And someone said, what are you looking for? What's your next project? And she said, I want to find something where I've got two women politicians. And my colleague that I was with said her eyes just got really big, and there Candy was like, do you have a political thriller with two women? And I'm like, actually we do. And so
blessings abound.
Let me check the old bag here. We sent it to her a couple weeks later. She loved it, and she raised a lot of the money, and I raised a lot of the money. But my preferred place to be is what I would call a creative producer. And I feel like a creative producer is the one that kind of gathers all the people together. So you put together the cast, the director, the cinematographer, the department heads, like the key department heads. You make this kind of package that you're happy with, and you go, I feel like this film can be made for this kind of money with this group of people. And then I feel like my job is to create this safe space for them to do their best work in. That's the best way I can describe it. So I have like another feature I'm working on called Kindred. That's a micro budget film we're shooting with a local director, Emily Barber, and a former Chicagoan, Emily Bennett, who's the actor writer. And we're going to shoot it in Montana. That it's about kind of the backdrop is the opioid crisis. And that will be the same kind of thing. I'll raise the money, but it's a much tinier amount of money. And I'll create a safe space for those people to work together.
Do you find it, which do you prefer, small budgets or big budgets?
Well, I've never had a big budget.
Or at least bigger budget.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things I think that people think about an acceptable loss is that we had, because of Jamie, because of Tika, because of Joe, that it was a big budget. Compared to some films, it probably seems like a lot of money, but it was less than what you have for like a regular TV show. Quite a bit less, actually. So I've never had just endless amounts of money.
Sure.
I actually think big budget movies, like I think I read something somewhere where somebody was like, yeah, we only got like $80 million to do this movie. I kind of think that that's immoral.
And yeah.
There's a part of me that thinks, I mean, I guess if someone's listening out there and they want to give me $20 million for the movie, I'm happy to take it.
Our listeners have deep pockets.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Go, guys. But I think that, for On an Acceptable Loss, we hired union crew. Everybody was, you know, no favors, nobody's working for $25 a day. And I think at this point with Joe and I, where we are in our career, it would be kind of like wrong for us to look at like a young person that wants to get into the business and be like, hey, will you do this? Will you work for us for 3 weeks for free? Yeah. But I think a sweet spot is like the, for movies, is to me is like the $3 to $10 million range.
Sure.
But I think the industry doesn't really like that. They want bigger budgets because they really want to make a lot of money.
Which is weird because some of the most successful pictures of the last few years have been done on pretty small budgets. Sure. I mean,
Moonlight, just
Moonlight, Get Out. That was made for like what, $5 million?
Yeah,
which is
four.
Four. I mean, in the world of Hollywood, that's chump change.
Yeah,
that's like that's an executive just like whatever. Like, here's $5 million, Jordan Peele.
Go make your little movie.
Yeah. So and I like what you're saying about bringing people in and paying them, you know, making sure there's no favors. It's you're going to get what
living wage,
wage, because it creates an accessibility for people to get into it. I mean, you've pulled from local talent. When I was watching An Acceptable Loss, one of the first things I noticed was like, hey, is that Rashad Hall? Is it from Rendezvous in Chicago? Yeah. I was so excited.
87% of our cast are Chicago actors.
Okay.
That's beautiful because it makes things livable. It makes things accessible. It gives people, I don't know, an ability to live a dream.
To practice their craft.
Yes. Yeah. This is what they want to do.
You mentioned probably one of your big goals as a producer is you wanted to create like a safe space for people to work in. Mm-hmm. Have you worked on shoots where that, I guess, where did that come from? You know, like what is
and
the importance
of that? I don't
mean
even safe like, oh, I feel like someone's going to.
No, like, of course, but a good like, work environment, right?
I think that it's so that you don't have, like, I think there is a lot of talk about like auteurs and the whole idea of like a vision. I don't know if you guys saw the documentary Harold and Lillian, but it's about Harold Michelson and Lillian Michelson, and he was a storyboard artist and she was a researcher. He drew frames for like Hitchcock and, you know, the Ten Commandments and stuff like that.
Right, okay.
And then you look at the film and you start scratching your head and you go, okay, those iconic images, are they really Hitchcock's or are they Harold's? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I think film is a collaborative art form. And so if you have a great cinematographer, like our cinematographer was a woman, which was really important to us.
Sure.
I think 3% of movies are shot by women. Dan Clancy was our production designer. He's an amazing guy. Our AD, Jimmy Giovanetti, he worked on Home Alone. These are people that have years and years of experience. And so you want to listen to them. You don't want to create a world where someone is going to get chewed out because they come up with a suggestion or even just get ignored or marginalized. I think that happens a lot on big movies. And I think that sense like you're practicing your craft, you're bringing what you bring to the table, and for people to dismiss it or not sort of listen to your view, I think you'll lose something in the end.
Sure.
I don't know if that answers. Why do you think we got to that point?
I think a lot of it, I spend a lot of time looking at specifically, I'm fascinated by the new Hollywood movement, as many people are, because we, especially in American culture, tend to cherry pick out of that era as some of the best American films, you know, typical ones like The Godfather,
I'm
Taxi
Walking
Driver,
Here,
Midnight Cowboy,
Taxi Driver.
I mean, and these are great films, but they did tend to reinforce this idea of the auteur, of the singular vision, perhaps none more controversial than George Lucas. People really look at him as like, what happens when you allow a single person to be the supreme arbiter of an idea, of a story, of a franchise? I was just curious, in your opinion, how do you think we got to that point, and can we get away from it? Are we getting away from it in film?
I don't think we're getting away from it, because I think we're already, so this is where I'm not going to be able to say their names, but like,
redacted.
Lars von Trier. I mean, like, who's the guy that directed The Favorite?
Oh, Yorgos
Lanthimos.
Okay, so like those guys like come out, make this big hit, big splash, very creative, and I think that this happens is like you make one big hit, critical hit, and from then on you're going to get a critical blessing.
Yep.
It doesn't matter what. I mean, I love Scorsese. Taxi Driver, one of my favorite movies of all time. There's been a few movies of his that have come out lately that I haven't really thought were, you know, the same level of just like, you know, awe-inspiring. And I think it's two things. I think it's one is the idea that one person, everything they make, no matter what they make, is going to be brilliant. Or every performance they do, or every, you know, composition that they write. And then the other side of it is the whole concept of an auteur, to me, because 100-200 people work on a movie, and some things happen just by accident. Someone's standing there and they go, hey, Joe, what do you think about this? And if Joe's open, he'll go like, that's great. Let's do that. And then it might end up being, there's one moment in An Acceptable Loss where we showed at the Chicago Film Festival, and it was a very diverse, I don't want to give it away, so I don't know how I can finish describing this, but it was a very diverse audience, and there's a couple places in the movie where people jump or get startled or something like that. And this moment was this diverse audience gasping that something happened to a person, a brown-skinned person. Yeah. And because we're white people, we couldn't see that was going to resonate.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, that's fairly common in film, and I think that's why it's important to go see movies in an audience that might be more diverse. I don't know how this is going to sound, but I don't know. I saw Get Out with a mostly black audience,
yeah.
And I was like,
We saw it together.
Yeah, mostly black audience. I literally could not imagine watching that movie any other way, because it gives you a context. It gives you an ability to understand the horror of this movie. You're not watching just like a thriller. You're watching a true horror movie that people really identify. Yeah, they live it. They identify with it. I wish I had seen Sorry to Bother You with a bigger audience, one, because I think people were not as aware of it as I would have hoped, but a more diverse audience, because, as you said, we don't have that context just by nature. We grew up white, for me and Connor, we grew up white men. And, that's something that we take with us into the movies. And to be able to get out of that, I think, is important. And really the object of film, I believe it was Roger Ebert that once said, it's an empathy machine.
Yep. It
gives you the ability to experience someone else's lives or thought processes. None of us will ever really know what it was like to have to make a unilateral military decision that killed millions of people, so many people.
Sure.
But we can sure get into the headspace through Tika's performance and understand the villainy of it through Jamie Lee's performance. I wanted to bring up again that this film is now available to stream. You can rent it on Amazon, iTunes, pretty much anywhere that you get your movies. And it's also going to be playing at the Midwest Independent Film Festival. That's going to be tomorrow from when you're listening to this. You're hopefully listening on a Monday.
On a Monday.
Yeah. This is going to be tomorrow at First Tuesdays through the Midwest Independent Film Festival. So get out and see it. Connor, I believe you seem like you wanted to say something.
Oh, no. I was just preparing myself to breathe.
I think we all are. Sometimes watching this movie, I had to prepare myself to be like,
I know. I'm thinking about that war room scene, man. It's sticking with me.
Yeah. If I had to, and I'm not this type of person that is just like, this is the scene. This is the best scene. But if I had to pick one of the key scenes for me, and I think one that people are really going to enjoy, it's getting into the war room and seeing how this plays out, because it's devastating. It's very real. As I said, it's very prescient. I want to cap it off here with what's next for you. You mentioned that you have Kindred coming up.
I have Kindred coming out. Joe just finished. Joe would be here, except that he is flying home. He just finished Godfather of Harlem, which is an epics.
Yeah, epics.
TV show with Forest Whitaker, Vincent D'Onofrio, Giancarlo Esposito.
Oh, I love that guy.
Wow.
Shot in New York with the true story of Bumpy Johnson, who was a African-American gangster in the early 1960s. So he just wrapped shooting. He's got a few more weeks of editorial.
Naturally,
And then we'll see. We've got a couple. He's got a great political thriller TV show that we'd love to get going. We just, we need time to write and develop. So
well, there's so much time and so much talent to pull from,
especially in Chicago.
In Chicago. Thank you so much, Colleen.
Absolutely.
We really appreciate it. Again, this is Colleen Griffin, fantastic filmmaker and producer. The film is An Acceptable Loss. Watch it now. You got time tonight. I'm sure you do. Just give it. It's under 2 hours. It's a tight 145. Yeah, it's tight. It moves quickly, and I think you're going to really love these performances. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us for another week of Chicago Film Talk. Going to remind you about we're going to be at the Gene Siskel Film Center
on Saturday.
No, Friday. Friday, February 8th.
Yep.
We're going to be doing the introduction and Q&A for Rendezvous in Chicago. So get your tickets now. We love that. We loved Rendezvous in Chicago. So many great performances, and also directed by Michael Glover Smith, friend of the show, and produced by Lane Marie Williams of Women of the Now. Women of the Now also worked on the film. So if you want to support local film, you got plenty to do this week. You got an acceptable loss on Tuesday.
Come on.
You got Rendezvous on Friday.
Come on. Let's go.
All right. Thank you again, Colleen. This has been No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we'll see you all next week.